Well, I will welcome you officially this time. We're glad you made it here to the Michiana Adventist Forum and found us at our alternate location today. And we'd particularly like to thank our neighbors and friends here at the United Methodist Church who have made their facility available to us. And it's obviously a very comfortable and pleasant place to be. So we really do appreciate that. Our program today is Intelligent Design, Revolutionary Science, or Reactionary Religion, being presented by Dr. Ronald Numbers from the Department of History of Medicine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Following Dr. Numbers' presentation, we will, as usual, plan to have a time for questions and discussion that Gary Gray will help us coordinate. As we begin our time together, I'd like to pause for a moment, and Jim Hayward from the Andrews Biology Department is going to offer a word of prayer.
Dear Father, thank you for this day. Thank you for rest. Thank you for an opportunity to talk, to think, and to converse on interesting things. And thank you that we can be together today. Amen.
To mention some of the upcoming forum programs that we have on the schedule. Next month, I guess it's next month, isn't it? 2007, January 27, Dr. Jerry Gladson, an Old Testament scholar on the faculty of Columbia Theological Seminary in Georgia, will be here discussing, is there room for Ecclesiastes at the Christian and Adventist table? Dr. Gladson is currently working on a manuscript involving Ecclesiastes, and if you looked at your new Sabbath School quarterly that you might have picked up today, you can see that next quarter Sabbath School lessons are on Ecclesiastes. Dr. Gladson, in the past, served in the religion department at Southern Missionary College, and some of you probably had him as a teacher or a colleague down there. He currently serves as the senior minister of the First Christian Church of the Disciples of Christ in Marietta, Georgia. The following month, Dr. John Baris, professor here at Andrews, and a practicing clinical psychologist, is going to present what he has titled Dancing with God, a Limbic Perspective on Hermeneutics. And without going into a lot of detail, Dr. Baris will be presenting what he calls an emotion-based as opposed to a linguistic-based approach to interpreting the biblical materials, trying to emphasize more the feelings and the emotions that are there that we sometimes overlook in our enthusiasm to get back to the Greek and Hebrew words and the more cerebral ways of approaching the Bible. Then in March, on March 10, Dr. Daniel McMahon, who is a physician from Australia, will be here discussing his research on Ellen White's health teachings. You may have seen advertised, there's recently had a book published by Pacific Press, I believe in this country, called The Prophet and Her Critics, subtitled A Striking New Analysis Refutes the Charges that Ellen White Borrowed the Health Message. It's an interesting coincidence, which I didn't realize until last night, that Dr. McMahon's book has a whole chapter discussing a book written by today's presenters. I think chapter 4 in his book is called Prophetess of Health by Ronald Numbers, is the chapter title. So I'm sure it would make an interesting forum presentation if we could turn the tables and get today's speaker back discussing Dr. McMahon's discussion of his book. But anyway, gets a little convoluted. But so we invite you to come back. I guess if we had a topic like that, we'd probably need to find a venue not just only off campus, but probably clear out of the county somewhere. I don't know. Well, if you would like to receive email notifications of the forum meetings and of last-minute changes in venue and other information, there are a couple sign-up sheets in the back that you can, as Debbie is holding up one, they're in the kind of the back pews there, and you can put down your name and email address so we can try to keep you up to speed. There's also a basket, a table back there by the back door that if you should want to contribute to the cost of using the facilities here today, we'd welcome your help. Well, as we begin our discussion today, I'd like to read a few lines from a defender of freedom from many years ago, the English poet John Milton, from one of his essays. He says, "Our faith and knowledge thrive by exercise, as well as our limbs and complexion. If the waters of truth flow not in a perpetual progression, they sicken into a muddy pool of conformity and tradition. Where there's much desire to learn, there of necessity will be much arguing, much writing, many opinions. Give me liberty to know, to utter, and to argue freely according to conscience above all liberties. And though all the winds of doctrine were let loose to play upon the earth, so truth be in the field, we do injuriously to misdoubt her strength. For who knows not that truth is strong next to the Almighty? She needs no policies, no stratagems to make her victorious. Let her and falsehood grapple. Whoever knew truth to be put to the worse in a free and open encounter?" Well, our program today is entitled Intelligent Design, Revolutionary Science, or Reactionary Religion. As I mentioned, Dr. Ronald Numbers is with us from the University of Wisconsin in the Department of the History of Medicine. And he'll be speaking to us about the recent history of the creationism movement and intelligent design, in particularly in North America. You may know he has written the book that's sort of the definitive history of creationism in America, called The Creationists, and it's just been recently republished, the pages of new information, and it's just came out here just a few weeks or months ago, I believe. Dr. Numbers has published many, many books and articles in the scholarly literature, have been incredibly productive academically. In fact, Jim Hayward brought in two bags full of some of the books of Dr. Numbers that he owns personally. In fact, this is, I believe, Jim's copy that we're showing off here. The book that really made Dr. Numbers famous in Adventist circles, or some would say infamous in Adventist circles, was his book published 30 years ago, Prophetess of Health, a study of Ellen G. White, which really, I think, transformed Ellen White historical studies and other studies within the Adventist community. It was reissued in a updated version, and I understand that it's about to come out in a 30th anniversary edition, published by Erdmann's, I believe, this time. He's, you know, published many other books, and to go through all his publications would take up all of his time. But I would mention that he is a graduate of Southern Missionary College, the degree in mathematics and physics. He earned his PhD with an emphasis in the history of science at the University of California, Berkeley. And after completing his PhD, he taught here briefly at Andrews University in the history department, moved to Loma Linda University, and I remember seeing his name on an office door when I was a medical student out there. I don't think we ever met, but we were at least on the same campus. And then in 1974, he joined the faculty at the University of Wisconsin, where he's remained. He is the Hilldale and William Coleman Professor of the History of Science and Medicine, and has chaired the Department of the History of Medicine at the university. And he has, as I mentioned, written, edited a couple of dozen books and numerous articles. Just to mention a couple of them, his book Darwin Comes to America, published by Harvard University Press in 1998, Disseminating Darwinism, the Role of Place, Race, Religion, and Gender, published by Cambridge University Press in 1999. Numerous articles, one published in a book from Johns Hopkins University Press entitled Sex, Science, and Salvation, the Sexual Advice of Ellen G. White and John Harvey Kellogg, many other publications. He is edited the journal ISIS, which is the flagship journal in this country of the history of science. And he's got many other projects in works or in planning stage, including a biography of John Harvey Kellogg for the Harvard University Press, and potentially down the line, a biography of his grandfather, W.H. Branson, who was president of the General Conference. And we could go on. He's the current or past president of various professional societies, and we are very fortunate to have you with us today. We are honored, we're delighted, and we'll turn the time over to you.
Well, I'm very happy to be here. Always find I get an especially warm welcome when I visit a Methodist church, and the Methodists of Berrien Springs have been most hospitable this afternoon, so thank you, John Wesley. I, a few minutes ago, saw a dear old friend of mine, Dick Ritland, walk in, and I'd just like to take this opportunity to dedicate the presentation this afternoon to you, Dick. No person has had greater influence on my thinking in this area than you have. We could be meeting on campus if it weren't for you, probably. But I love you anyway. We've heard a lot of talk in recent years about something called intelligent design. It's certainly the hottest topic in anti-evolution studies in the last 10 or 15 years, has already generated a landmark legal case associated with Dover, Pennsylvania, has prompted many journals and magazines to carry front page stories suggesting that the entire community of biologists and other scientists in America is divided over the issue of intelligent design, and yet I think we don't know all that much about the origins and the goals of the leaders of the intelligent design movement. Back in the early 1980s, as some of you here are able to recall, two states, Arkansas and Louisiana, passed laws that mandated the teaching of creation science whenever something called evolution science was offered in public school classrooms. Now, creation science was, in effect, Seventh-day Adventist creationism, going straight back through George McCready Price and Ellen G. White. It was a very literal, strict interpretation of Genesis with a focus on the geological work of Noah's flood. In 1982, a federal circuit court in Arkansas declared that the Arkansas law was unconstitutional, and subsequently the case in Louisiana made its way up to the Supreme Court, which ruled in 1987 that mandating the teaching of creation science was unconstitutional because it violated the separation of church and state. So that presented a new challenge for anti-evolutionists in America. Back in the late 1960s, the Supreme Court had ruled that the old 1920s laws that remained on the books were unconstitutional, banning the teaching of evolution. Now the Supreme Court in 87 rules that teaching creationism as science is unconstitutional. How do opponents of evolution get into the curriculum? It didn't take long for anti-evolutionists, not necessarily the same people who had been promoting creation science, but anti-evolutionists nevertheless, to regroup. And this time, they regrouped around a slogan called intelligent design. One of its first appearances was in the late 1980s in a book called Of Pandas and People. And that, we've learned in the last few months, or about a year ago actually now, had a very interesting history. It turns out, from looking at drafts of this book that were submitted under subpoena in the case in Dover, Pennsylvania, that until 1987, the authors were defending creationism. They even had creation in one of their suggested titles for this book. The authors hoped that the Supreme Court would back the teaching of creation science and would provide a huge market for sale of their books, because there were not many good books out for teaching creation science. When the Supreme Court ruled against the creationists in 87, the authors of this book simply stripped out references to creation, slipped in the phrase intelligent design, and marketed it under the title Of Pandas and People. Now, that shows a little bit of the continuity between the anti-evolution movement of the early 1980s and the intelligent design movement of the 1990s. However, I don't want you to attach too much weight to this, because as I'll be showing, I think both intellectually and demographically, the young earth creation movement, or the scientific creation movement, and the intelligent design movement are considerably different. Now, the first person to bring national attention to intelligent design was a Berkeley attorney named Philip Johnson. Johnson had not been particularly religious, but he had a domestic crisis in his middle years, turned toward religion. And during a sabbatical in England, he discovered the diatribes of Richard Dawkins supporting evolution, and especially atheistic versions of evolution. And Johnson was already beginning to wonder about what was happening to Western society, and reading Dawkins focused his attention on the influence of something called methodological naturalism, also sometimes called by the intelligent design people scientific naturalism, although they're two quite different ideas, I think. So what had happened, according to Johnson and his soon-to-be followers, was that science had become an agent of naturalizing virtually all of our culture and pushing the sacred to the margins of society. And that this was a huge mistake, and that if Christians, and at the beginning they were mostly Christians, if Christians wanted to recapture Western culture, they had to start out by attacking methodological or scientific naturalism. So that, from the very beginning, has been the central enemy of the intelligent design camp. Now here, we need a little bit of history. Of course, it's all history this afternoon, but a little bit of earlier history. People who investigated nature, until the early 19th century, typically called themselves, in antiquity, philosophers, in the early modern period, natural philosophers, natural historians, maybe physicians occasionally, studied the natural world as well. And if you were, say, a natural philosopher, as was the great Isaac Newton, one of your goals was to understand God's workings in nature. You'll never find a book, I think, called natural theology and religion. There wasn't the separation between natural theology and natural philosophy and religion, because natural philosophy encompassed the appropriate parts. Isaac Newton himself had to appeal to God to correct the irregularities in the solar system. And it wasn't until the mid-18th century that French astronomers and mathematicians were able to show that these were self-correcting, and that you didn't need God to come in from time to time to adjust the system and get it in work, in working order. However, by the early 19th century, and in some circles decades earlier, investigators of nature rather quickly adopted a new set of rules governing their investigations, the most important of which was that they would restrict themselves to natural explanations. And this wasn't coming primarily from people hostile to Christianity and revealed religion. Many of the most prominent advocates of methodological naturalism were devout Christians. In fact, one of the big ironies of this story was that the very phrase methodological naturalism was, as far as I can tell, coined by a Wheaton College theologian and philosopher in the early 1980s, first published in the Christian Scholars Review, as advocating the best methodology for a Christian who is a scientist to use. Now, people who advocated methodological naturalism were trying to separate it from metaphysical naturalism. That is, it didn't make any difference whether you were a Christian, a Jew, a Muslim. When you went in to explain the workings of nature, you would arbitrarily and voluntarily limit yourself to natural explanations. No cheating in saying God did it or Satan did it or anything like that. You might believe that as a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim, but it wasn't science to interject that. And it wasn't unique, this mythological naturalism wasn't unique to scientists who were just beginning in the first half of the 19th century to call themselves scientists rather than natural philosophers and natural historians. Historians, whether we are Christians or not, use the same rules. Most of us do anyway. That is, when we're trying to explain the past, we don't say, and on December 13, God sent down, or Satan did this. That's just not considered to be good history, although you might believe that events like that happened if you are a Christian or a theist. It's just not something that you're going to get into a peer-reviewed journal or book. Most scholars have adopted methodological naturalism, and most Christian scholars found it perfectly acceptable until the early 1990s. Philip Johnson developed what he called the wedge strategy, that he would drive a wedge into the log of scientific or methodological naturalism and split it apart. And his hope was that he and his followers could re-sacralize science. And here's what I think most people don't understand when they think about intelligent design. The goal of the intelligent design leaders is to abandon the commitment to naturalistic explanations and to allow supernatural ones to be considered as legitimate science. Now, probably the second most influential book in this intelligent design movement came out in the mid-1990s by a Catholic biochemist at Lehigh University named Michael Behe. Science was worth a darn, it would cure the common cold, I think. Behe titled his book Darwin's Black Box. What was the black box for Darwin? It was the cell. And B, he said, if you looked, as he did, carefully at the structures of the cell, one would find irreducible complexity. Irreducible complexity. Now, he liked to use the analogy of a mousetrap, that a mousetrap, I think, has five working pieces. If you don't have any, if you have one of them missing, doesn't do any good work. It's irreducibly complex at five pieces, so it couldn't have evolved naturally. Now, critics of Behe have shown that his basic assumption is fallacious, that you actually could catch a slow mouse with four pieces. And with two pieces, you could create a tie class, and with one, you could have a keychain. And as long as there is some function for the individual parts, then natural selection would have a role to play in this. And so maybe it's not irreducible. Now, for Behe, who by this time was associating with Johnson and another and a small group of relatively young, very bright, well-trained scholars, the discovery of irreducible complexity led to a declaration that they had brought about a major scientific revolution. A major scientific revolution. Behe himself said that this discovery should rank in the annals of science along with the discoveries of Newton, Lavoisier, Einstein, I think he even mentions Darwin, and Schrödinger. So this is no minor discovery. And if you accept Behe's point that he has discovered scientific evidence of the supernatural in discovering irreducible complexity, then it probably should rank up there with the discoveries of the inverse square law or, Schrödinger's equation, something like that. The problem is that most critics didn't believe that he had discovered anything remotely equivalent to a major insight into the workings of nature. In fact, many critics, including evangelical Christians, said, this is nothing but the old God of the gaps explanations that we had in the 19th century. That is, whatever science couldn't explain, you attribute it to God. Very risky business, because when science did come to explain some of those processes and events, then God went out of business for them. And most scientists would say, if you find something that looks right now to be irreducibly complex, that's a great problem to work on for the next 25 or 50 years, and maybe you'll explain it. If you think that it's truly irreducibly complex, created by God in that way, you're probably not going to have much incentive to try to understand why things appear to be the way they are. I think most people who write and talk about intelligent design see intelligent design as a benign movement to give credit to God for the complexity of the world around us. And probably close to 90% of Americans are theists, who presumably, or at least most of them presumably, believe that God had something to do with the origin and design of the world. Pointing out this sort of complexity in nature, as our own Dick Ritland did with a book, Design in Nature, years and years ago. Were you the first intelligent designer? Maybe. Has been called for centuries natural theology. And natural theologians, well, thank you. I had another one too, but yours might be stronger than mine. Are you a doctor? Okay. Good. Now I'll be making noises in my mouth. Now, if this were an intelligent design lecture, I'd know exactly where I was. But it's kind of not intelligently designed. Dick Ritland, I was saying, came up with design. Natural theology, that's it. Okay. Most people who do not accept intelligent design as a scientific conclusion see it as a late 20th century form of natural theology. And as a fairly benign form of natural theology. The problem is that the advocates of intelligent design insist, stamping their feet up and down sometimes, that it is not natural theology. Because, and I go back to my major point, they want to revolutionize the practice of science. They want to change the most fundamental rule governing the practice of science. To say it's natural theology is to marginalize it in the very way that people like Philip Johnson and Michael Behe disliked so much and prompted them to engage. Some of you may know that the major source of funding for intelligent design has come through the Discovery Institute in Seattle, Washington. Sometimes tracing the money is a good idea to find out what's behind these movements. There have been three organizations, three philanthropic organizations that have provided most of the money for the Discovery Institute to operate. Actually, it's a center within the Discovery Institute for them to operate. One of them was from the Weyerhaeuser Foundation, the Forest Products Group, and Davis Weyerhaeuser was a very active evangelical Christian until he died a few years ago, and would sometimes support the American Scientific Affiliation and other groups, and he contributed a fair amount to this. A group I know little about, the McClellan Foundation in Chattanooga, Tennessee, has contributed significantly. But the biggest donor to this movement has come out of the Christian Reconstruction movement. How many of you know what Christian Reconstructionism is? Okay, and the rest of you are too scared to raise your hands. Christian Reconstructionism is an ultra right-wing Presbyterian movement led by somebody named Russus Rushdoony, who once, well, Rushdoony died a few years ago, but these people want to create a Christian theocracy based on Old Testament laws, literally based on Old Testament laws. And one of his wealthiest supporters has become enamored of intelligent design and has been funneling millions of dollars into this movement. Now, I know a number of the people associated with the Discovery Institute. I think it's fair to say that they are not theocrats themselves, but their biggest funder is a theocrat who says, well, he's become a little more moderate than Rushdoony himself. He said, instead of stoning gay people, he thinks that conversion would be good for them. So that's we won't do the stoning anymore. But most Christians, I would assume all Seventh-day Adventists, would have a very difficult time getting too close to Christian Reconstructionists. Now, as one might guess, one of the biggest battles here has been over the public school curriculum. The intelligent design people have wanted to get their anti-evolutionist teachings into the public schools. finding the right strategy to do that, or the right tactics to do that, have been extremely difficult. We know now that the first test case in the courts that came out of Dover, Pennsylvania, required that teachers expose their students to intelligent design and direct them to go read this book of Pandas and Peoples in the library, the several dozen copies of which were contributed by a local evangelical church. When this came to trial in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, late in 2005, the judge happened to be a conservative Republican Lutheran man. They couldn't have had a more sympathetic judge. After hearing all the evidence, he issued a scathing denunciation, dismissing it as a breathtaking inanity that had no justification to be taught in the public schools of Pennsylvania. This was nothing but religion, and to call it science was essentially a joke. Already, however, the leaders, especially those at the Discovery Institute, were revising their tactics. Several of them had been scheduled to testify as expert witnesses in the Dover trial. They pulled out. Behe did testify, and another person who was an intelligent designer remained. But by this time, the people in the Discovery Institute were convinced that the case was going to go down the tubes, as it did, and began to advise other school districts that they should require teaching the strengths and weaknesses of evolution. It might be good to teach the strengths and weaknesses of almost anything we teach in schools, but this is a slogan that really means, let's teach the weaknesses of evolution. They already feel that the strengths of evolution are being taught far more than they should be taught, and they want to provide cover for teachers to focus on the weaknesses of evolution. Who's in this group? It began as a reasonably diverse body, and it's grown increasingly diverse in the 15 years or so since the movement has gotten off the ground. With respect to creation scientists, or young earth creationists as they're sometimes called, it represents, I think, a distinct demographic group. Remember, creation science, despite the last name, is biblical creationism. It's the Seventh-day Adventist view of the creation story and the flood. The advocates of creation science invested a tremendous amount of energy and proved to be extremely successful in promoting this idea among conservative Christians who overwhelmingly, even fundamentalists in the 1920s, did not believe in the recent special creation of life on Earth. That was an idea almost unique to Seventh-day Adventists in the 1920s and in the decades just before that. So the advocates of creation science began in the 60s and 70s and 80s to try to wean Bible-believing Christians away from interpretations of Genesis such as the gap, a day-age theory, I can explain them later if you need explanation, and to regard young earth creationism as the only valid interpretation of the first chapters of Genesis. The intelligent design people, in contrast, have from the very beginning spurned any discussion of the Bible. They do not want the Bible mentioned. After all, this is real science now. The leaders of the movement say, let's bring all opponents of evolution together under a big tent, and we'll gather strength that way. It's divisive among anti-evolutionists to insist that only one interpretation of Scripture is acceptable. So although all young earth creationists I know of believe in an intelligent designer, believe in God, many of them have been very irritated at the attitude of the leaders of the intelligent design movement who have gone out of their way to distance themselves from young earth creationism and have even disparaged young earth creationists as troublemaking and divisive Christians. You can understand why they might not like that too well. So there has been remarkably little overlap between the creation science and the intelligent design movement, despite the evidence that we have, and certainly can't deny, of this one textbook of Pandas and Peoples starting out as a creationist book and landing up as an intelligent design book. I think it's atypical of the movement generally. It's very difficult at times to know who's who and what's what. The critics of intelligent design go out of their way to describe it as nothing but old-fashioned creation science dressed up in fancy clothing, and they often use more colorful language than I should use in a church. Because, of course, if young earth creationism has been scientifically refuted, and this is nothing but another version of that, then there's no heavy work to be done. It's hard to tell from public opinion polls just how strong intelligent design has grown. Most public opinion polls don't even differentiate between young and old earth creationism, much less intelligent design. Some people I know believe that young earth creationism has grown weaker in recent years as intelligent design has eclipsed them. But my feeling is that most of this impression is based on news coverage, and the intelligent design people are getting far more news coverage right now than the young earth creationists. I don't see any diminution at all in young earth creationism. Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And he was reading two books by Philip Johnson. So I innocently asked him what these books were about. And he said, they're about intelligent design and evolution and those problems. And I said, well, how does this Johnson guy explain all the fossils? And he says, oh, he attributes the fossils to Noah's flood. That's when the fossils were laid down. Now, if any of you have taken the time to read any of the intelligent design literature, and especially Philip Johnson's book, he never even comes close to that explanation for the fossil record. This man, an obviously intelligent, successful person who was taking the time to read Philip Johnson, knew Philip Johnson was an anti-evolutionist, and just assumed, if you're an anti-evolutionist, you must be, not realizing that this was something that Johnson actually repudiated. Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And he was reading two books by Philip Johnson. So I innocently asked him what these books were about. And he said, they're about intelligent design and evolution and those problems. And I said, well, how does this Johnson guy explain all the fossils? And he says, oh, he attributes the fossils to Noah's flood. That's when the fossils were laid down. Now, if any of you have taken the time to read any of the intelligent design literature, and especially Philip Johnson's book, he never even comes close to that explanation for the fossil record. This man, an obviously intelligent, successful person who was taking the time to read Philip Johnson, knew Philip Johnson was an anti-evolutionist and just assumed, if you're an anti-evolutionist, you must be attributing the fossils to Noah's flood, not realizing that this was something that Johnson actually repudiated. It's very hard to tell why the intelligent design camp has flourished so much in so short a period of time. Maybe it just proves that if you give 10 people in a think tank a few million dollars a year, they can do a lot with a good public relations campaign, and they have had a superb public relations campaign, getting op-ed pieces in the New York Times, getting all the major news magazines to cover them, getting recently the Prime Minister of the Netherlands said, we should be teaching intelligent design in the schools of Netherlands because it may be the one thing that can unite Christian, Jews, and Muslims, or maybe not. Sometimes I wonder if the success of these movements is related to a lack of adequate public education and familiarity with evolution. I think it's pathetic in our country at almost every level. But then I'm not sure also that education is a solution here. In many ways, I kind of at least empathize with the opinion of the governor of Kentucky, who recently said, what's the controversy? These are self-evident truths accepted by about 90% of our public. And I think that that's what we really have to remember. Roughly 90% of Americans are theists who believe in a designer God, and we shouldn't be surprised at all that many of them have come to accept a weak version of intelligent design. That is, intelligent design as natural theology, if not the harder, strong version of intelligent design as representing a new type of science altogether. Thank you. So you can clap in church now?
We have questions. Can I ask that in the endeavor to get everybody included in the questions, if at all possible, that we have short questions rather than long speeches? And that way we try to get everybody involved as much as possible.
We often hear the intelligent design argument mentioned in the context of the anthropic principle. Could you give a couple of comments on that?
You're right. There's more influence going from the anthropic principle to intelligent design than I see going from intelligent design to the anthropic principle. So I don't know if everybody's familiar with the anthropic principle, that the universe is fine-tuned in such a way as it to support life, and if things were off by just a little bit, we wouldn't be able to be here this afternoon. And it's an argument that intelligent designers have included in their arguments for an intelligently designed world. But I don't see the people who were strong supporters of the anthropic principle embracing the whole intelligent design movement. In fact, I sense a little uneasiness there. Yes.
Yes, it seems to me that the probability that anything originated by chance or by intelligent design is a function of its complexity. The more complex it is, the more probable it is that intelligent design was involved in its origin. I believe that the complexity in all aspects of nature is so great that the probability of intelligent design is extremely high. I understand that the human brain, which I believe weighs a few pounds, is made up of 100 billion cells, and in it there are 100 trillion or one quadrillion neural interconnections. I do not believe that this type of complexity can be accounted for on the basis of random processes. I don't see intelligent design as either science or religion. I do believe it is irrefutable logic.
I can think of something much more complex than the human brain, and that's God. Did God have a designer? No. We do not think, if you believe in a God anywhere closely related to the traditional Judeo-Christian God, then you don't accept your own logic. You have to start somewhere. You're either going to start with a God who has no antecedents, or you're going to start with a natural world that doesn't have any antecedents and go on from there. Logically, I think they're equivalent. Now, for various reasons, we might choose one or the other. In fact, most of us do make choices like that, but I don't see that there's any logical difference there.
Just a question about sort of a motivation, you know, involved in the movement. If I understood you correctly, I sense that you see a kind of a sort of a socio-political, religious motivation behind the leaders of the movement. And yet, certainly reading some of the work and briefly meeting Behe and having actually have had Paul Nelson come over to class on several occasions, one of the intelligent design folk, my sense is that these are genuine academics who are actually sensing that this is on to something, not just a, sort of a political agenda. I wonder if you could comment on that. There seems to be a little bit of a disconnect here between what I'm perceiving, the picture you're painting, and my sense from some of the participants in the movement. And of course, those two don't necessarily have to be identical. That can happen. But I wonder if you could comment on that.
Well, you cited my favorite intelligent design person, Paul Nelson. I've known Paul Nelson since he was an undergraduate. And I think Paul Nelson is one of the brightest, most upstanding people around. And he knows biology. He might be a philosopher of biology, but I think he really knows biological science as well. And I would never question his motivations for getting into this. He was a critic of having, of trying to force this into the public schools from the beginning. He and Johnson have been at odds over the politicizing of this movement from day one. Paul Nelson is an anomaly. Paul Nelson is one of only maybe two people prominent in the movement who will describe himself as a young earth creationist. He's no 6,000-year-old creationist, but he does claim to be a young earth creationist. So on several grounds, he remains atypical of the leadership. And so I'd like to preserve him as an island of sanity. No, I'm just kidding. I do. I think he is really, really good. And I've had him up to Wisconsin, too. He's excellent. He's as non-polemical as any of them.
Thank you. I appreciate your presentation. George Agoki from Andrews University.
Okay.
Do you think we should necessarily ask all questions and answer all questions? A question such as, did God have a designer?
Yeah.
What is so difficult about saying we don't know? A lot of what we call science today is filled with a lot of inexactitudes.
Exactly.
And we should be humble enough to say we don't know when we don't know.
I couldn't agree with you more. And if I don't think then we should fault the logic of people who say we don't know where the world came from. It's not a failure of logic, I think. No, I agree with you.
You know, I think you actually quoted that 90% of Americans are theistic designers. From a natural selection standpoint, why are such a high proportion of the population theistic?
I'm sorry?
From a natural selection standpoint, why are such a high proportion of Americans theistic?
Must have survival value of some kind, eh?
Yeah, that's but it seems to actually frustrate evolutionary science that how can this happen? So I kind of wonder from their perspective, why is theistic perspectives so survivable?
Story.
Hey, it helps us cope with the unknown.
Yeah,
maybe. Or maybe natural selection really hasn't worked that much with the emergence of the human brain, and that culture is more dominant now. I don't know.
I'm a sociologist.
Yeah, I thought.
Thank you, sir. My name is Jason, undergrad student at Andrews. And my question is, as an evolutionist personally, I don't hear a lot about theistic evolution, but I do know that a lot of Christians today are embracing that as opposed to intelligent design. For example, you know, the Catholic Church has officially accepted teaching that I've heard. I'm not a Catholic, so I wouldn't know. But so I guess my first question is, what are your thoughts on that? On the growth of theistic evolution? And secondly, as you mentioned, do you think there's a problem in that it just pushes it back, theistic evolution, to one step further, and that is God, which you also have to explain away, as in there's no antecedence to God? So that's my second question.
You're absolutely right that theistic evolutionists, despite what I would assume to be their numerical strength, get very little attention. And I think the key reason is that they're an echo, they're not a choice. Most theistic evolutionists I know say, we will let biologists and others work out the sequence and mechanisms for the history of life on Earth, and we believe that that's how God did it. So they're not rejecting anything, they're not adding much to it, except the Bible doesn't tell us how God actually did it, and science can, and so we'll just use whatever science discovers as God's mechanism and, in effect, baptize it. Now, it's hard to quarrel with that. You can say, well, you know, that's not scientific. Well, it's not scientific, I guess, but there's not really much to say, is there? Whereas you have the intelligent designers saying they want to do away with the commitment to naturalism in explaining the world, or the creation scientists who say they want to squeeze everything down, maybe the whole universe, to 10,000 years. You've got something to argue with there. I think the theistic evolutionists are just too loosey-goosey to present a good target. And some of my best friends are theistic evolutionists.
Could you tell us how you think, what you feel about Richard Dawkins?
I can tell you what one of the leaders of the intelligent design movement recently said about Richard Dawkins. He wrote him an email, and he says, you are God's gift to the intelligent design movement. And I tend to agree with that. I think not only did Dawkins initially spur Philip Johnson into writing his book, Darwin on Trial, but he has provided incredible amounts of ammunition in the next 15 years for these people. I hate it. Here you have on the one side, fundamentalists been claiming for decades, evolution is inherently atheistic. Now you have a big time Oxford biologist saying evolution is inherently atheistic. It just cuts out all the ground for these middle people who are trying to harmonize things with theistic evolution or some other scheme. Plus, I was saying this morning in my talk, I think he could threaten the teaching of evolution in America. Now, some of you might like that, but I wouldn't. For this reason, our schools are supposed to be religiously neutral. If evolution really is intrinsically atheistic, then it's not theologically or religiously neutral, and maybe teaching it then would violate the separation of church and state. Not even Dawkins would like that, I think. So I find him very provocative to read, but he does elicit strong responses from me. Same with Sam Harris.
Did I hear you right to say that the Adventists are the authors of young earth creationism in the 20s?
The proud creators of scientific creationism, yes.
Elaborate a little bit. What about Bishop Usher and Judaism's literal acceptance of creation?
No, nothing. Okay, I'll give you the two-minute version. Cut me off if I go on past 2 minutes. When geologists and paleontologists, mostly Christians, many of them clergymen were constructing the geological column between roughly 1810 and 1840. It forced Christians to reinterpret the meaning of Genesis. How do you accept this evidence coming from good Christian men? Well, you loosen up "they" means age, or you put a gap in there between the first and third verses of Genesis 1, and you can accommodate it. By 1840, even evangelical Christians in the U.S. and Britain had abandoned using Noah's flood to do any geological work. Yes, there was a biblical flood, but it didn't leave any geological traces. Okay, so from then until 1906, roughly, when Price publishes the Illogical Geology, he published an earlier book, but it really doesn't push it quite as much as the Illogical Geology. Nobody in evangelical or proto-fundamentalist circles is advocating this view. It disappears virtually. Now, there may have been people who believed it, but they weren't writing about it. They didn't leave records, written records. And then Price, because he had converted to Adventism, and he said he would never have developed this system of flood geology without Ellen White, not Genesis, without Ellen White's inspiration and guidance, then develops this into something called flood geology, which gets renamed creation science or scientific creationism about 1970. And in every denomination that I've looked at where you can find people adopting this, there's always a connection back to Price. That was 2.5 minutes anyway. So yeah, I think one could make a strong case, which I will make, that the three most influential Adventists ever were Ellen White, John Harvey Kellogg, and George McCready Price. Most of Price's influence has come since his death, but it's been tremendous.
Would you interpret John Paul II in the papal letter, "Truth Cannot Contradict Truth," as a theist who is what you call an evolutionary theist? And if not, why? And I was just wondering, relative to theism being 90% of the American public, how would you make the divide between theistic design and theistic evolution in terms of where Americans stand?
I have to confess I'm not familiar with the term theistic design. What does it mean?
Well, no, that was just the way I was phrasing what you were saying about intelligent design, theists who believe in design. There are a lot of theists in America who believe in evolutionary theory in terms of the type of...
Yes.
That you just... And I would actually associate what John Paul said about evolutionary theory being a well-confirmed hypothesis that doesn't contradict Christian teaching.
More than a hypothesis.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But
remember,
he just got dissed.
But that's not been repudiated within the church that I understand.
Yeah, but the... Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know how familiar you are with the
Cardinal Schönbrunn? Yeah, I was at Phil Sloan's seminar.
Said it was just a throwaway line from the Pope that carries no weight at all, and he's been backed up by Benedict in some way. So I don't know what's going on. I keep hearing reports coming out of the Catholic Church about the extent to which Benedict is supporting Schönbrunn, the extent to which Schönbrunn overstated his case, and even he doesn't want to be allied with intelligent design now. And I haven't seen anything definitive yet. I think it's kind of it's an embarrassment to some Catholics and a hope to others right now. So I don't have any good answer for that.
I really think you ought to be a little careful about stating God is complex. First, I don't think we know enough about God to make that statement. Secondly, having studied philosophy and theology, I would like to say that the first person who uses the statement that God is complex has been Richard Dawkins.
Yes, what?
Richard Dawkins is the first one that used the argument that God is complex. If he is complex, who designed this complexity?
Oh, no, that argument goes way, way back. That's not original with Dawkins at all. And if you want to read about the complexity of God, you could start with the writings of Ellen White, who talks about some of God's characteristics, which seem pretty complex to me.
Professor Numbers, I would like to follow up a question that an earlier person in the audience asked. You said that the spread of young earth ideas into other denominations always can be traced back to the influence of George McCready Price. I was wondering, if we introduce Hans Reichenbach's distinction between the context of discovery and the context of justification, if there's anything interesting. In particular, do people accept, in the contemporary era, do they accept the young earth views on the basis of Price's authority or White's authority or something like that? Or are they simply inspired to see Genesis in a different way because of hearing something from Price?
No, in fact, its origins in Adventism was a huge liability for decades. It wasn't until Whitcomb and Morris repackaged Price's ideas in the early 60s, and they consciously played down their indebtedness to Price. He seemed not to mind too much. Nobody who is a young earth creationist wants to attribute it to Adventist influence that I know of. Although Morris and Whitcomb are quite happy to say that they got everything lock, stock, and barrel from Price. But they believe that's because Price was interpreting the Bible correctly, not because Price was influenced by Ellen White.
Thank you.
And no, I don't think that there's a significant difference between the context of discovery and the context of justification. I think it's been wiped out.
First, just a comment. When you talk about theistic evolution, it seems to me that that Philip Johnson could be described as a theistic evolutionist. The writing that I've read two or three of his books, that he seems to pretty much accept evolution. What he strongly disagrees with is a naturalistic explanation of evolution. So it seemed like there'd be room within the intelligent design camp for people who are theistic evolutionists.
Logically, I can't tell any difference, except that the leaders of the intelligent design movement beat up on theistic evolution as evangelicals, or satanic or something, compromised with evolution. They detest theistic evolution, but I don't see any reason why they should. The one person there who has come the closest to admitting to maybe being a theistic evolutionist is Behe. If anything, Johnson is actually becoming more biblical and conservative in just the last few years, and he's not moving toward theistic evolution, I think, at all.
I was thinking of his early book, like Darwin.
Which one?
I was thinking of something like Darwin on Trial.
Right. I don't see anything in there against methodological naturalism that wouldn't be compatible with a fairly robust theistic evolutionism. Yeah. But they hate theistic evolution, by and large. Not all of them, but most of them seem to hate theistic evolution.
My other question that I was debating about, and I didn't know I was making any motions indicating that I was debating asking a question, but anyway, that was going around my mind, and it's something I've thought about for some time. And that is whether it is really possible to teach science in the classroom and to think about, science in a very professional way without raising some of these questions with regard to the origins, where things come from, to whatever extent there's design, what's the source of that. And it seems like we sometimes are trying to make a divide, say, well, you can't go there, when just as human beings, we would raise those kind of questions. Do you have any comment on that?
Yeah. I think most science educators today in America are weak-kneed fraidy cats. And I think they've far overreacted to fears of lawsuits. I think that there is no reason why a science teacher in a public school should refuse to deal with questions that students ask. That's what you call the teaching moment. Some kid says, but my preacher said this, and you explain, well, but that's a view derived from religion, and then the scientific evidence is that. But I think that there is an unnatural and unhealthy reaction. People, a lot of teachers are scared to death of getting in trouble with principals, parents, preachers, school boards, and so the best thing for them is to just stay away from it.
Okay, we have two questions and we'll stop there.
The question of making a distinction between difficult, unanswered, and unanswerable questions seems to be overlooked in many instances. At times, because there are mechanisms of mutation, does not imply that you can apply procedures that would be called scientific to issues of origin. Yet, it seems like both in creationism and in evolution, the idea is that you should be able to apply science to the first cause. Any comments on that?
All I can say as a historian is it's a long time contested territory. And there have been both religionists and scientists who at times have said, let's move those questions of origins outside the boundaries of science because we're not going to answer them scientifically. And then others say, oh no, let's get them in there and start to find out as much as we can. We might not have the ultimate answers to things, but we know more about the origins of life today, let's say, than 100 years ago, or more about the origins of the universe. And so maybe it wasn't a good idea. It wouldn't have been a good idea to set those aside.
Your Big Bang, for example, comes from singularity, which is nothing. And within the first 100,000 of a second, depending on where you're reading, it's an expanded size of the solar system. There are not realms to either falsify or prove or replicate or attempt to deal with it. Also,
so are you arguing for putting the Big Bang in a category with God, where you don't try to explain origins?
No, you recognize that necessarily one alternative approach or another, you're still is not fitting within the normal framework of what would be called scientific. You don't have, and there are mechanisms that go beyond. In other words, what is working would not work without mechanisms for which, at this point, we do not have approaches in science to deal with. It's beyond chance, but it's beyond proof.
But not beyond hope. I mean, many scientists would say, okay, you know, we'll struggle with that one. That's a really tough one, and we might not be able to answer it in 100 or 200 years, but maybe we will. There are a lot of questions that are being answered now that...
To say, put a label on it and say it is because of something where we have yet to be able to demonstrate it, that becomes the question. In other words, to say it is God or to say it is chance.
Yeah.
In other words, at times we say because we can do something, well, everything falls into it. But in reality, if it is beyond the approaches we can use, this is something that either is unanswerable or unanswered at this time. And I think at times there is an attempt to put everything in one bag.
Oh, I agree. I think that there are questions that are not suitable for science to answer, and I'd be willing to bet a lot that they'll never answer them. That other people would say, oh yeah, let's make that part of scientific investigation. And that's why I say it's under negotiation all the time. When you get, the inner core of science is pretty simple in term. There's a lot of agreement about most of chemistry, for example, and a lot of physics and a lot of biology. It's when you get to these big questions or to the outer areas, the outer boundaries of science, and you get to talking about the social sciences, if indeed they are sciences, that the questions really get hard. And so people sometimes arbitrarily, I think, will say, no, we don't want to include this as science, or we don't want to, you know, we make sure we want to get this in as a scientific teaching. There's been a lot of pressure from various groups over the years to try to get particular things included as science. And in the United States, the body that typically makes the final decision would be our courts. You want to know whether chiropractic is science or quackery? You go to a federal court and they decide it. You want to know whether creation science is science or not? That's where we make the decision. And I don't know that's the best place to make it, but that's where we do, in fact, in practice, make those decisions.
You said that The major financing for intelligent design is from the Christian Reconstruction Group, and their goal is a theocracy. Then this is just the methodology. Forget the science and so forth, all the people in the trenches discussing right and wrong and how to teach our children. Really, there's a methodology to achieve a theocracy, abolish the First Amendment, and so forth.
You're going to have to run that a little more slowly by me.
Okay. First, did I understand you say this is the major financing is from the Christian Reconstruction?
The single biggest donor to the Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture is
their Christian goal is not the right or wrong or not the science or the not. The goal is to achieve a theocracy. They've just chosen this method.
Well, you see, part of achieving a theocracy is to resacralize our culture. And the Discovery Institute people want to resacralize science. They want scientists to be able to invoke supernatural explanations when warranted by the evidence, of course. Okay? So that dovetails with the resacralization project of the Reconstructionists. Now, as I said, I don't know of anybody at the Discovery Institute who wants to move on to institute a theocratic political system here, as the Christian Reconstructionists apparently want to do. So, but I can see why the Christian Reconstructionists would have an influence, would have an interest in at least supporting this, and even Johnson calls it the wedge strategy. And he would stop before you get too far, but others who are supporting him would want to go much further in terms of creating a real theocracy in the United States.
Okay, let's stop there. Let's thank Dr. Numbers for being here. Let's stand, and Jerry first will have our benediction.
Our Heavenly Father, Lord, we thank you for the blessings you give to us, that we could be here today on this Sabbath day and deliberate on these great issues. And Lord, I thank you for the message that's been given to us, and help our minds as we chew on the things that we've heard here today that come close to your truth in a knowledge of you. In Jesus' name, amen.